From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Is the Confederate flag an essential part of Southern identity?
Surely there are other symbols that better reflect who we are than those of the Confederacy.
That's Paul in Northeast Georgia. We'll talk about what Southern identity is and how it might change. But first, last week, the break room wondered whether or not to remove Georgia's Confederate monuments.
Yes. All of them immediately, starting with Stone Mountain. We should sandblast the entire side of the mountain.
You want to sandblast Stone Mountain?
Absolutely. Return it to its natural condition as closely as possible.
That is Break Room regular Hector Fernandez. Here are your first thoughts.
Hey, my name is Tim Pangburn. Do you have any idea how big that is and how ineffective sand is to rock? It's not feasible.
Hey, my name is Joel. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. The statue on the side of Stone Mountain is big enough to house a car inside of the horse's mouth. So the idea of sandblasting it is a little misguided. We're really talking about tons of dynamite and creating a place below to catch all of the boulders and parts of the mountain that fall.
Paulus Wood tweets to us, Confederate monuments, I don't care one way or the other. Take it down, leave it up, no skin off my nose. And here's another message, this one from Athens.
Hi, good morning. My name is Susanna Drennan. I've just been wondering if the ones that have to stay or decided to be kept have to stay, would there be some merit in adding verbiage, really saying what these people believed in, what they fought for, and not whitewashing it so much?
We always love to get your opinions. We know you have them, so call and let us know what they are. It's 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Twitter or Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. By 1861, 11 states had seceded from the Union to form the Confederacy. The Civil War's end in 1865 put an end to that coalition. But the ideas behind its formation are still very much alive. The League of the South is a white nationalist group headquartered in Killen, Alabama, and it wants those same 11 states to again leave the U.S. After being involved in the Charlottesville chaos, the leader of that group, Michael Hill, posted on Facebook, quote, "The South will once again be in name and in actuality white man's land, a place where we and our progeny can enjoy Christian liberty and the fruits of our own labor unhindered by parasitical out-groups," end quote. With me to discuss this is Roxanne Donovan, psychology professor at Kennesaw State University. Hi, Roxanne.
Hi, morning.
And it should be noted that her views are her own, like I think pretty much any professor that we have on here. Her views are her own and not those of the university. It's probably also true of Trey Hood. He's in Athens. He's a political science professor at the University of Georgia. Hi, Trey.
Good morning.
Trey, let's start with you because, look, ever since 1865, there have been people calling for the South to secede again. Is there any reason to take these new calls seriously?
You're correct. There have been people that have long talked about seceding. It's all just really silly pie in the sky at this point, or ever since 1865. In addition to ending slavery, of course, the Civil War decided once and for all whether or not a state would be able to voluntarily leave the Union. And the answer was clearly no. So there's really not a whole lot to discuss from my vantage point on this question.
Well, I have lots
more
questions.
Talking,
we're
going to
keep talking because I have more questions. But Roxanne, there are people who are very serious about seceding. And we have seen a rise in militia groups. They are heavily armed, some of them. What kind of state of mind leads to this idea that you would want to secede from your own nation?
So I don't know of any studies that have looked at secessionists themselves, but there are lots of studies that look at prejudice. And they are personality characteristics that predict prejudice as well as on the extreme violence against outgroups. And some of them are right-wing authoritarianism. Despite the name, people on the left and the right can be high on right-wing authoritarian. And what that is authoritarian aggression, so aggressive tendencies towards out-group, authoritarian submission, submission to in-group authorities, and then conformity and traditional values. There's also high social dominance orientation, and that's a belief and an endorsement that some groups are allowed to have more power and more resources, so are able to dominate other groups, and a belief that some groups are more superior than others. And there are also a bunch of other things that can lead people to more extreme viewpoints and to have prejudice ideology. So an external threat. And for many people, Barack Obama is president, so a black man is president, was a threat. And then you saw a rise in hate groups and hate crime and aggression. The belief that you are a victim of potential inequality. So your group that's on top and those on the higher ends of the social group hierarchy are more likely to endorse right-wing authoritarianism and social dominance orientation. So when they believe that equity is about to happen, so outgroups are about to gain footholds of fairness and equality with the higher order social group, then all of a sudden that in and of itself becomes threatening.
Right. Okay, so Trey, let me go back to you, because even if it's illegal, right, for a state to secede, I can't imagine a lot of people are worried that an entire southern state will secede, right? But we have seen instances of times when either militias or communities have decided to so-called reclaim their territory. A classic example is just about 40 miles north of Atlanta in Forsyth County, where the whites, through violence and intimidation, basically ran all of the African Americans out of that county. So is there something short of a state's secession that could be of concern?
Well, possibly. I don't know that it's necessarily related to the question of secession. I mean, these right-wing radical groups are going to be there one way or the other, whether they're talking about secession or not. It's just become sort of a knee-jerk reaction from some of these groups. Whether or not it's possible, or they think it's possible to secede, really doesn't matter in terms of, it's not going to change their ideological viewpoints. So I was talking about secession in terms of, I mean, there are still a lot of people who perhaps think that it's possible for a state to secede, but of course the answer is no at this point, or has been for 150 years now. Or really, I guess you could argue it has been for since 1789, once the Constitution was ratified, because states could voluntarily opt into the Constitution but cannot voluntarily opt out. Now, of course, the Southern states in the Civil War, or just prior to the Civil War, argued that they could opt out. But again, the answer clearly was no from what occurred during the Civil War. So
Roxanne, that brings us back to you. Let me play you this comment. This is an unnamed white supremacist protester who's in Tennessee, and from a video he uploaded to YouTube.
The Southern people, as a native group of organic culture, I mean, they deserve the right to exist, just like any other native people around the world have the right to have their own country.
And let me play you one more. Again, this is Michael Hill. He's leader of the secessionist group League of the South.
The Bible talks about nations, and it means peoples, tribes, clans, groups of individuals that are connected by blood. So when we talk about the Southern nation, we're talking about not political entities. We're talking first and foremost about our people. And who are our people? Our people are white European Southerners.
Roxanne, you're a psychology professor. What are you hearing there?
So a disclaimer, I haven't treated any of these individuals, so I can't tell what's in their minds, but I can tell you what research suggests. And what you're hearing is that social dominance orientation, which in this manifestation looks like white supremacy. So my group is better than your group, and thus my group should be allowed to exist.
Is that different from them let's say that their response was, this has come from an interview I've done, but this, what if their response was, I'm not talking about white supremacy, I'm saying I should be allowed to live with the people that are part of my so-called tribe.
Right, that same isolationist view is about white supremacy, that other groups are less than, and thus I should be allowed to isolate with my group because we will thrive as a result of not having multiculturalism and diversity. So, I mean, you can use euphemisms for it and say it's about white nationalism, but at the crux of it, it's about white supremacy.
Trey, was there anything that any party, any leader could have done along the way to address secessionism and put the question to bed in the past 150 years?
Well, I think there have been efforts to do that. Again, it seems to be secession seems to be a knee-jerk reaction sometimes from Southerners in relation to a lot of different historical events. And again, I think there's some misunderstanding among possibly some individuals out there that it is possible still to secede, which it's, again, not. So,
could economically or politically, could the Southern states survive without the rest of the United States?
Well, again, it's sort of hard for me to even, I mean, that's just a hypothetical question that's never going to happen.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I've read various accounts of, you know, what the South may have looked like if the Southern states had been successful at secession, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's possible, but again, that's just not something that's going to happen.
It's just a thought experiment as far as you're concerned.
It is. It's just sort of a counter history experiment, if you will.
I think that extreme ideas can have a foothold. It can go from the mainstream, from the margins to the mainstream. And I think part of what's important is that we understand that. I mean, we can hold the belief that there are rules and there are laws to prevent it, but they were rules and laws in place that should have prevented the secession movement to begin with. And what I'm worried about is these extreme ideas and ideological violence is moving from the margins to the mainstream.
Okay, it's interesting you say that, because here I'm going to play you a comment from somebody who's in the Cal Exit movement, just so we don't think this is only about Southerners. We only have about a minute and a half left, but he's talking about California's possible secession, and here he is on Fox News.
We're going to do things that are going to be beneficial for our state, and we disregard what the United States thinks or even their laws. For example, our marijuana, sanctuary cities. We just, if it's good for the state, we're going to do it, regardless of what the federal law is.
Is that the same mindset that you're talking about in terms of isolationism?
It's about isolationism, but I think the motives behind California wanting to secede is very different than the motives behind the South wanting to secede. But the means of let's just go on our own and create some extreme movement so that we don't have to deal with other people with different ideas is the problem. I mean, at the end of the day, there are always going to be some on the side of inequity, violence, and domination. And there's going to be some on the other side about equity, peace, and cooperation. For the majority of us in the middle, though, we're going to bend with the prevailing winds. And that's the scary part, right? Depending on whether we're in a space where our leaders, our parents, our community say, okay, difference is deficit. Diversity is bad. Let's just make sure that we isolate to prevent ourselves from that. Or difference is about diversity, and it's good, and let's promote peace, equity, and love.
That is Roxanne Donovan. She's professor of psychology at Kennesaw State University, and Trey Hood is political science professor at UGA. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Claire.
Thank you.
Just ahead, who would have thought Atlanta would love soccer so much? First, though, we will break down what it means to be a Southerner. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Some people jokingly refer to the war between the states as the late unpleasantness, or maybe the war of northern aggression. How about the Civil War? Because as events in Charlottesville sadly echoed, it was anything but civil. And it's not something to joke about, either. What are the legitimate pleasures of being a Southerner? How do we deal with the realities of our history without winding up replaying them? With him now is Chuck Reese, editor of The Bitter Southerner, and also Regina Bradley, professor of African Diaspora Studies at Kennesaw State University. Hello, Chuck and Regina.
Hello there.
Both in the studio with me. And from a distance, we've got Sam Burnham, curator of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. Hi, Sam.
Hi.
Okay. I think we have to start with Confederate monuments and the Confederate flag, since that's the issue facing the nation. And I'm going to begin with you, Sam, because I know that you very much defend the idea that these monuments and these markers and these flags are part of heritage and shouldn't be taken down. Why?
Well, for me, I see that as it points us where we were. And I think if we're ever going to look at where we're going, we have to remember where we've come from. And I believe they play a role in telling our history. I think our history is so much bigger than that. The South has probably one of the most diverse histories of any region in our country. But I really just think that for so many Southerners, the monuments especially now, less so than the flags, play a role in telling our history and our story and knowing where we've come from.
Regina, you're shaking your head.
So let me go ahead and give my disclaimer that all of my opinions are my own.
Yes.
I don't want any drama. No, I mean, from that aspect, I do agree with Sam in the point that Southern history is very diverse. The problem that I have is that the Confederate memorials only represent a certain aspect of that. And there's not enough critical engagement about what that history is. So when we have these conversations about the South, particularly outside of the South, the Confederacy and the Civil War are the main cornerstones for how we think about Southernness, particularly Southern Black folks. And as a Southern Black person, I find it very problematic that we have these conversations, but yet fail to mention the fact that, yes, we have this diverse, complicated history, but part of that diverse, complicated history is slavery. And we just can't call it by its name. It's like, no, we don't want to talk about that. It's uncomfortable, but yet it's part of the foundation for why we had a civil war in the first place.
Okay, but let me play you a comment from one of our listeners, Chuck. This is Paul in Winterville, Georgia.
My name is Paul. I live in Winterville, Georgia. I've lived my whole life in the South. My family's been here since the early 1600s. All my relatives live in Georgia and adjoining states. And I understand that the South, the Southern colonies and Southeastern states have a four-century history. The Civil War is just 4 years out of. What I can't understand is why some Southerners feel that those 4 years, when people here decided it was all right to kill their fellow Americans in defense of a so-called right to own other human beings, is the best and highest emblem of our heritage.
So in your opinion, Chuck, you're another hometown Southerner. I mean, dyed in the wool, right?
Right.
So in terms of the Civil War, why has that become such a cornerstone of Southern identity?
Well, you know, it's interesting to me because I was listening to what Sam said about how the monuments, you know, they teach us about our history. They remind us about our history. Well, these monuments have been up since. They were put up primarily in the 1890s and in the 1920s. So most of them have been standing for at least in the neighborhood of a century or more. They were never teaching tools to me. No one ever used those monuments as teaching tools to me. Regina and I were talking about this in the green room before, but there's... I remember after the shootings at Emmanuel AME in Charleston 2 years ago, can't remember what the headline was, but Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote a piece in which he excerpted all or most of the Confederate States secession declarations,
yeah.
Right? You read one paragraph into any of them, you know the purpose was to own other human beings. The purpose was the maintenance of slavery. And I was 52 when I saw that. I went to public schools. I went to the University of Georgia. I took all these history classes. No one had ever put that in front of me. If we were going to use these monuments as teaching tools, our teachers would have started a long time ago, and they didn't.
Okay, so Sam, let me, and look, I'm not asking you in any way, shape, or form to endorse the opinion of a white supremacist, but we're going to play you this comment from Robert Ray, speaking with Vice News, and he's talking about what the South means to him, why he was rioting, and the reason I'm playing it is because of this idea that the Confederate flag is not about the Civil War, but it's about Southern identity as being rebellious and standing up to authority. So here it is.
Well, for one thing, it means that we're showing to this parasitic class of anti-white vermin that this is our country. This country was built by our forefathers. It's sustained by us. It's going to remain our country.
Sam, you don't have to defend Robert Ray. But what about this idea of the rebel, the Southern rebel?
Okay, I think that there's a part of the Southern culture that says, you know, we're Southerners and we don't listen to the opinions of all these other people out there from the other regions that, you know, they're the ones that are talking about we're marrying our cousins and living in log cabins and do we have electricity and indoor plumbing and things like that, that I imagine we're going to talk about further.
Yes.
But at the same time, what I'm hearing from this person is that the South is only about white Southerners. And that is to discount so much of our culture, of what, how the South was built over those four centuries that we heard mentioned in an earlier comment. I believe that there is a resistance. There is a, you know, the South has historically been the beat up stepkid of the United States or whatever. And, you know, we've just sort of had to live with that over our years, and we've earned a lot of it. But at the same time, I believe that there is something in that that says, you know what, we're still a little bit independent. We're still our own people. We're still our own region. And we don't have to take this abuse from, you know, the other areas of the country.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Sam Burnham of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia, Kennesaw State Professor Regina Bradley, and Bitter Southerner editor Chuck Reese. Okay. Regina, we were kind of dancing. We've mentioned a couple times the fact that history hasn't perhaps not been taught completely in the South. This is something that Trey Crowder talks about quite a bit. Trey Crowder is also known as the liberal redneck. Here he is in a video that reacting to the events in Charlottesville.
One of the saddest parts to me is I know these guys, they think they're patriots. You know, fighting for the real America with their swastikas and their Confederate flags. Man, I don't know that there's any symbol that's more inherently un-American than the Confederate flag.
So let's talk about the part of Southern identity which is the real red-blooded American.
The what?
Well, real America.
See, I've
made them all laugh.
So, from the two clips that you just played, Celeste, something was going through my head. There is this assumption that the South is monolithic. And this is, I'm not saying this is what Sam was saying. I actually agree with him in this aspect, is that there is a more diverse history behind that. The problem is that we've been packaged as this monolithic, everybody believes the same thing South. But as a Black Southerner, I cannot repeat this enough. We are often waved or connected or rolled into this assumption that, yeah, everybody was a rebel. How can I be a rebel as an enslaved person? My idea of rebellion was running away. You understand what I'm saying? So I really find it fascinating that we are continuing to have these conversations without acknowledging the fact that we have to own up to the aspect that we didn't allow everybody to rebel. It was to rebel in a particular type of narrative, to rebel in a particular type of way or experience without recognizing that, well, we're not exactly doing that for everybody who's in the South.
But then how do we, Chuck, how do we create a Southern identity that is inclusive?
I think many people have taken many steps for a great many years to create that kind of inclusive identity. When you talk about the idea of rebellion as a concept, to me, one of the best rebellions that ever happened in the South was when Booker T and the MGs got together. And I say that a lot, but it's the truth. It's like, you know, you take all this wonderful soul music that was made at Stax, and it was made by a band, the house band in there, two Black kids and two white kids from Memphis. They couldn't walk down the street together. They couldn't go have a beer together. They couldn't go have a meal together. But they could go into that studio in Memphis, and they made music together, you know. You see these kinds of things in our foods. You see them in our culture, like the, you know, what we've been trying to do at the Bitter Southerner since we started it 4 years ago is point these things out to show how the best parts of Southern culture have arisen when people have crossed those lines and barriers that keep us apart. And to do that requires us to acknowledge what these symbols that we were all brought up with and that we walk down the street and see. You have to acknowledge that they don't represent the best of us.
All right. So, Sam, let me play you another comment. This is from author Chuck Thompson, admittedly a northerner. He actually would be okay with the South seceding, which nobody here is advocating. But here he is describing what he thinks is a strong aspect of Southern character.
A lot of Southerners bring to politics and bring to their lives, and you know, not this sort of sense of diplomatic horse trading that most people engage in when they're involved in a conflict. I'll compromise a little. You get what you want. Give me some of what I want. No, the evangelical mindset imbues in these guys this idea that we cannot compromise ever with infidels.
Sam, what about this idea of standing on principle and sticking to your principles without compromise? Is that a part of Southern identity?
I think it is on a broad scale, and I think that goes along all the spectrum, the various types of people that we find in the South, because again, it's a very diverse region. I think that there is something about that that says, you know, we're going to stand on what we believe is right. We're going to stick to it, and really, you know, defend ourselves and what we believe to be correct.
Regina,
what if what you believe to be correct is not correct?
Well, and I think that is a problem that we've run into throughout the South for a long time. It's a slow-changing region, and it always has been. And I believe there are things that we've had to learn that we have done wrong as a people in the South, like slavery, like Jim Crow, like the resistance to the Civil Rights Movement. Those are all things that we do need to be teaching and learning and understanding that sometimes that resistance to change is not a good thing. Just because it's part of our culture doesn't mean it's a good thing.
Okay, so we have a few tweets from listeners, and you're more than welcome to add your voice to this discussion. Nick Baum says, the old South is the current South. Taking down statues changes nothing. Never has there been so inexplicably smug a place. K.W. Oxnard says, the South has always been more politically diverse than many realize. I come from a long line of proud white Southern liberals. And Black Physicist says, Southern identity is probably socially problematic. Southern stereotypes are probably not nice. So if we were to create, they had this question bouncing around Twitter because someone from the South asked, look, if we get rid of the Confederate flag as a symbol of the South, what's going to replace it? I haven't heard, this guy says, I haven't heard any good suggestions on what would replace that as a symbol of the South. So let's brain meld on this. What could replace the Confederate flag, battle flag? Regina?
I don't necessarily know about a flag or a particular symbol. I feel like in this particular moment, we should be past uniform symbols of meaning representative of one major thing. One thing that I would suggest, however, is to have a more diverse representation of the South in pop culture. I can't stress this enough. We're an increasingly visual culture, so you have this whole debate about the new show that HBO has greenlighted called Confederate, which we don't really know what it's about. We just know what happened if the South was seceded and stayed. I'm not about that life. But, I mean, shows like Underground, for example.
Although you have the other one, Black America, from producer Will Packer, which is about what if we'd actually given African Americans their own states.
Right. So, I mean, to be able to have those diverse representations of not only Southern Blackness, but just Southernness in general, I think would be able to show that we are trying to be progressive in terms of not only how we market ourselves, because ultimately that's what we're doing, is marketing ourselves to a larger audience, but also how we are revising and considering what we are doing or where our place is in contemporary society.
Chuck, do we need a replacement for the Confederate battle flag?
I was having this discussion with my friend Patterson Hood from the Drive-By Truckers a few months ago, and we were talking about Booker T and the MGs, and he said, you put that on a flag, I'll fly it in my front yard. And, you know, in a way, he wasn't joking, because, you know, I'm with Regina. We should be past trying to find a symbol that represents this as a region. the point she makes is really, really important, because the examples of diversity in Southern culture are infinite almost, but they're not portrayed that way in the national media. You know, I saw that 25 years ago when I was covering the media business for Adweek magazine. It was any time you saw a magazine prototype or a television pilot that was about the South, you either got the polite garden party version or you got the hillbilly version. And those are the lenses the nation looks at us through. We are much more complex than that.
That is Chuck Reese. He's editor of The Bitter Southerner. We also spoke with Sam Burnham, curator of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. And Regina Bradley is professor of African Diaspora Studies at Kennesaw State. Thanks, everybody.
Thank
you. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Give us your opinions. Also, you know how to reach us on Twitter or Facebook, or just call us. Just ahead, it's time to play ball, the ball that you kick with your feet. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. Tomorrow we talk with people who used to hold extreme views and now don't, like a woman in Athens who joined a white supremacy group and then changed her mind. And we'd love to hear from you. Have you ever been committed to a set of beliefs that don't have to be extreme, but then done an about-face? What changed your mind? Give us a call and leave a message. We're at 404-500-9457, and then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. Over the past year, Atlanta has become a soccer city. That's thanks in most part to our new professional soccer club, Atlanta United. You cannot miss the black, red, and gold jerseys that fans are sporting. And in about 3 weeks, the season kicks off at the Mercedes-Benz Stadium. Joining me in the studio is Atlanta United president Darren Eales. Hello.
Morning, Celeste.
So is Atlanta United tapping into an existing fan base, or is it creating a new one?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think I'll go back 2.5 years ago when I came to the city to start preparing for the club. A lot of people said Atlanta wasn't a sports city. I mean, clearly that's a load of rubbish, as we've seen from the crowds that we're getting. But I think, you know, there's been a number of factors. Firstly, I think soccer's just been growing as a sport in the country of America. So that's a factor. I think, you know, it's an international sport and we have a young international demographic in Atlanta. But I think the big thing is, it's a city of transplants, and I feel like it's the team that everyone seems to be getting behind. So it's a club that, let's say you're from Philadelphia and your dad took you to an Eagles game, you're always going to be an Eagles fan in NFL, but you don't have that baggage for soccer. And it just feels like Atlanta United's been that team that everyone in the city can be proud of and say that that's their team.
That may be the only time the Eagles has ever been called baggage. Let's hear from the club's co-founder, Stefan Kalvite. He says he hopes to drive up soccer fandom in Atlanta.
We also really wanted to be the kind of group that weren't soccer snobs. We wanted to bring newbies, people who had no idea about soccer, into the fold and not educate, but, you know, get them along to become fans.
He is the co-founder of the Footy Mob, named for Atlanta's hip-hop group, the Goody Mob, but they're fans of the team. How do you do that? How do you go about creating an atmosphere at a game that it welcomes people who know nothing about soccer?
Yeah, I mean, it's been an interesting one. We've got four different official supporters groups. So Footy Mob's one of them, but we've got Terminus Legion, Resurgence. So we've got a whole group of them. And what's been really great about soccer is that the fans are part of the entertainment. So they're the people that are singing, cheering. They do these things called TIFOs, which are huge signs that they'll spend a couple of weeks preparing before each match. So that's been an important part of Atlanta United, is trying to create that culture where all of the supporters feel part of the club. So, you know, for 2 years before we kicked a game, it was almost like a pub crawl every week, because we were going to every single viewing event we could for soccer games to try and engage the supporters. And what's happening is our supporters are the ambassadors now and the evangelists, really, for the team. So we didn't go after the fan that wasn't interested in soccer. We went after the fan that loves soccer, and then we're letting them bring their friends and show them how exciting the game can be.
So is there any concern that this could be a peak because they're new and that fandom might go down?
No, I mean, I think, look, from the way it's gone this season, every game sold out quicker and quicker. We've already sold out our first game at Mercedes-Benz Stadium. We did that probably 2 months before the game. So it's more of a sort of train going down the tracks, going downhill and getting bigger and bigger. And if you look at other clubs, Seattle, when they came in 9 years ago, were the gold standard for expansion teams. No one expected them to average 30,000 in their first year, and they now average about 42,000. We've come in at 46,000, so we've just got, you know, potential to go higher and higher. And with Mercedes-Benz Stadium, we can really, you know, the sky's the limit for us.
So I want to play you a comment from Richard Ellenbogen. He chairs the Department of Neurological Surgery at the University of Washington. And I'm bringing this up because there's such a discussion about concussions in football, and it's mostly around football, but it's also around football, right? It's also around what the Europeans call football, which is also soccer. Here's that comment.
Whether it's baseball, basketball, or soccer, it's just as high. And so this cuts across both genders, all ages, and all sports. This is not simply a football injury. And if we fall prey to the idea it's just football, we're going to miss the majority of the kids playing sports.
What kind of action do you think professional soccer is already taking, or are there things you think could be done in order to prevent these kinds of injuries?
Yeah, so soccer's got its house in order over the last couple of years, I'd say. I think back to my time when I used to be in the Premier League at a team called Tottenham, and we had a goalkeeper that got an injury, and it was on live television, and he clearly got concussed and came back on the pitch, and that was something that I think caused a lot of people to realise things need to change. Now, if you look at Major League Soccer, we have a concussion protocol now, so there's a third-party doctor at every game, and if there's any issue, then that player has to come off the pitch. We're fortunate as well in terms of the way we deal with our players is Carlos Bocanegra's, our technical director, actually suffered concussion injuries when he was a player. So he's someone that's very sensitive to the situation. And so I think, you know, it's something that's come a long way because you're right. It's just because it's not a heavy impact sport like American football doesn't mean that you don't get concussion injuries. I mean, I can remember once injuring myself when I ran into the goalpost because I scored a goal but carried on my momentum and that knocked me out. So there's many ways that you can have a head injury. So, you know, we're aware of that situation now. And I'd say that, you know, to be fair to FIFA, they've took a stance on making sure that this is looked at and that there's no issues where players continue to play.
What are the team's chances in the days ahead?
It's an interesting one for us. We always hoped that we could make the playoffs in our first season. Well, that would be the only team since Seattle that's out of the last 11 expansion teams to make the playoffs. We know it's difficult. Our local rivals, Orlando, are in their third season. They've still not made the playoffs. But I think we can do it. And once we make the playoffs, it becomes a single elimination tournament. So who knows what could happen. And the one thing we do is score goals. And if you can score goals, then, you know, get a little bit of luck, who knows.
That is Atlanta United President Darren Eales. The team's next game is Wednesday in Washington, D.C. against D.C. United. Darren, thank you.
Thank you.
A recent Associated Press investigation finds Georgia is not actually following a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that bans life without parole for juveniles who are convicted of homicide. 25 people are currently serving a no-parole life sentence for crimes they committed as juveniles. That's according to data from the Georgia Department of Corrections. Joining us to talk about this is Jessica Sino, professor of law at Georgia State. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
And also Stephen Reba, an attorney who directs the Appeal for Youth Clinic at Emory Law School. Reba also represented Robert Veal, a youth sentenced to life without parole. Hi, Stephen.
Hi.
Jessica, what exactly did the Supreme Court ruling say about cases that had already been decided, juveniles who were already in prison serving these sentences?
Sure. So in 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court said you cannot sentence juveniles to life in prison without parole, minus some very extreme conditions. And then, but that applied for all cases going forward. In this recent case from 2016, they then made that retroactive to anybody who was sentenced at that time as a juvenile to life without parole.
Did that also include direction on a timeline? What happens if a state does not comply?
See, and that's the tricky thing. The U.S. Supreme Court will announce a rule, but it's left to the states on how to implement that rule. And also, there's really no timeline. It just says you can't do this, or if somebody comes up with an appeal, here's the schema that you have to follow. But there's no real, you know, way of the Supreme Court even monitoring this. That's not a job that they have.
Yeah, that's not a Supreme Court thing. So, Stephen, all of these 25 cases that the Georgia Department of Corrections points to, these are all cases that fall under the retroactive category.
Most likely, yes. And I think it's important to note, I think to say that Georgia's not following the law is technically not correct. There's two ways to do this. If you have a unified court system, which Georgia does not, perhaps then...
Wait one second. Sure. Explain what you mean by that. What do you mean Georgia doesn't have a unified court system?
Each county is separate. Some states have a centralized state organization that governs individual courts. Georgia does not do that. So really, it's not that Georgia isn't following the law. It's simply we do things differently. So there is a mechanism for all of these inmates who qualify to pursue a challenge to their sentence. It's just that they have to independently do it. The state is not going to initiate that for them, which is a bit of a problem. It makes it difficult. There's no right to counsel at that stage in the proceedings. Theoretically, if an inmate petitioned the trial court, I believe, to correct their void sentence, the court would have to appoint a lawyer if they were indigent, but that's even a little bit unclear. So you have two hurdles. First, the inmate has to be aware they qualify, and second, they have to be, you know, have the legal knowledge to pursue this pro se, at least to the point where they get an independent lawyer.
How high a bar is that? How likely is it that somebody who was convicted as a juvenile is going to know that they can get their sentence reduced and have access to be able to get that going through the courts?
It's certainly something it's certainly a resource we are trying to provide at Barton. And there was a case 3 or 4 years ago called Moore v. State, which invalidated many life without parole sentences for juveniles imposed between 93 and 2005 for a little bit of a different reason. They said the 2005 case of Roper v. Simmons, which outlaws the death penalty, applied retroactively to Georgia law because Georgia law required a defendant to be eligible for the death penalty before they could get a life without parole sentence. Now, that's a little confusing.
It is a little confusing.
Right. The point is a whole bunch of inmates there also qualified, and what we did is we sought those inmates out, asked them if they wanted...
You went and found them. It wasn't them.
Correct.
For the most part.
Correct.
Jessica, let me play you this comment from Scott Burns. He led the National District Attorneys Association, and he's speaking with NPR here back here in 2012. He's saying that the reason they ask for life without parole for a juvenile offender is because these are the very worst of the worst.
It is seldom used. It is one of the most gut-wrenching decisions a prosecutor will ever make in her or his career. But there are those just simply incredibly... painful, difficult, horrific cases where, you know, it should be an option.
So what was the Supreme Court's legal justification for saying we should not put a juvenile away for the rest of their life?
Well, so part of it is it's founded in science, right? That a juvenile's brain and their ability to have judgment skills and impulse control is reduced compared to that of an adult. And so very much what they grounded their decision in is actual science. And what we saw instead, I mean, in the 80s and 90s, we came up with this idea of a super predator, right? That there are some kids who are just so bad, we should lock them up and throw away the key. And that's really, I mean, that was part of the notion of, okay, it's about punishment, it's about retribution, it's about finality. And we've never had a criminal justice system that is really focused on rehabilitation, for example. But we know, based on now decades of research, that you can, in fact, rehabilitate, especially juvenile offenders, that the way they are as juveniles is not necessarily indicative of who they're going to be as adults, even if it's for the most worst of crimes.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Jessica Sino. She's law professor at Georgia State University and attorney Stephen Reba. What value, then, does the legal system place on rehabilitation? Has that changed? In other words, is part of this the idea that a juvenile can be redeemed down the road?
That's right. And it's important to note that in the most recent Supreme Court decision in Georgia in Veal, the trial court has to impose specific or find specific legal findings in order to impose a life without parole.
I should mention, you're talking about the case of Robert Veal, someone that you represented, and he was a juvenile sentenced to life without parole.
To clarify this, a trial court cannot impose a juvenile life without parole sentence in Georgia unless he finds the defendant to be permanently corrupt or irreparably incorrigible. So that is
But what does that mean?
Yeah, what does that mean?
Okay. Well, and that's I think will be, so what will happen is trial courts will find these defendants to be irreparably corrupt. Those cases will be appealed and we'll get decisions from the Georgia Supreme Court that will define those terms for us. I can tell you from my personal experience, having spent thousands of hours in Georgia's prisons over the last decade talking with these kids, I've yet to see one that I would deem permanently corrupt or irreparably incorrigible. Even the worst offenders who have done horrific things as juveniles cannot meet this standard. You know, every parent sees intrinsic goodness in their child because they know their child. They're the one person on earth who knows the child. And it's a lawyer's responsibility in these hearings to present these mitigating facts showing that these people are still have redemption.
How does this affected then, Jessica, by the tendency, and Georgia actually does this quite often, of trying a juvenile as an adult?
So, you know, in Georgia, I think there is this the odd system where, you know, there are, what, 8 crimes, and I think Steve can correct me if I'm wrong, but there are 8 crimes where the juvenile automatically gets tried as an adult, which is crazy. You know, and it's so hard to actually ever get that case back to the juvenile system at any point, but it's an automatic, you know, from age 13 and up that these kids get put into the adult system, which, again, just having a child who is facing, you know, even if it's not life without parole, if they end up with a sentence of 40, 50, 60 years, that's a life sentence. Let's be honest about what that is.
Stephen, you wanted to address that as also?
Just simply to say that I hope where we are, you know, under the Eighth Amendment, which is about cruel and unusual punishment, we talk about evolving standards of decency. And where I think we're going with this case is to the point where hopefully all cases involving juveniles start in juvenile court, right? Let's have a juvenile court judge. They're the best equipped to look into these kids' lives. They have the services to do it. Let's figure out who these kids actually are first and then decide what the appropriate court is for them. But let's make sure we're not missing incredibly important facts. Many of these kids have spent a significant amount of time in our child welfare system, and we need to know who these kids are. And let's do that first as opposed to at the very end when we're trying to untie a very difficult knot to untie, which is a life without parole sentence. But we should start at the front end before we transfer these cases to adult court and say, who's this kid? What has this kid been through? You know, what do we know about this child? And we have very capable judges who spend and dedicate their lives to doing that, and we should let them do that.
That is Attorney Stephen Reba. We also spoke with Jessica Sino, law professor at Georgia State University. Stephen and Jessica, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And that's it for today's show, but we would love to hear from you. We talked earlier about Southern identity. So what is your take on what it means to be Southern? What is the Southern identity? You can reach us on Facebook or leave a message at 404-500-9457. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.